is the fall line. Our paths have crossed with journalist and podcaster Maggie Freeling several times over the past 3 years. We cover cold cases that have received little attention, and Maggie investigates wrongful convictions. So we're lucky enough to know many of the same great advocates and experts. As we've become friends with Maggie, we've learned more about her career, starting with NPR's Latino USA and shifting to focus on incarceration and the criminal justice system. Her work is important, whether she's raising Patreon funds to support exonerees and their families, or organizing letter-writing campaigns to reopen cases. Though some listeners may know Maggie from her appearance on Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray, her journalistic career has been focused on justice, or, more specifically, injustice. Her earliest reporting looked at wage inequality among women in the New York City fast food industry. And at Latino USA, Maggie was often on assignment at the southern border, where she covered many issues, including abuse at detention centers. In a 2019 piece called Skeleton by the Lake, she covered one forensic scientist's quest to identify a decedent found in Michigan. That story also revealed the, quote, difficulties of identifying Latino remains in the United States. Maggie's background in public radio, crime, and justice reporting is obvious in her podcasting. Her projects, Unjust and Unsolved, Suave, and Murder and Alliance, each focus on the criminal justice system and incarceration. Unjust and Unsolved is, to our knowledge, the only show to take on a new wrongful conviction case each week. Like its sister show, Murder and Alliance, it's part of the True Crime Obsessed network. We sat down to talk with Maggie about her work on Unjust and Unsolved, Murder and Alliance, PRX's Suave, and a host of other topics, including youth incarceration, sentencing, and her work with Jason Baldwin of the West Memphis 3. Maggie, I think most of our listeners might know you from hosting Oxygen's Maura Murray documentary, but I actually first became acquainted with you through your reporting with NPR's Latino USA. Can you talk to us a little bit about what drew you into investigative reporting and your background?
Yeah, so it's funny. Going into true crime was not something I ever thought I was going to do. And, you know, missing persons and wrongful convictions is a lot of criminal justice stuff, but I guess we call it true crime. But I was really into looking into human rights abuses. I did a lot of detention center reporting and border reporting when I was at NPR's Latino USA. And it was through that I wound up getting really involved in the criminal justice system. Not to bore listeners, but I was looking into PREA reports, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, in detention centers. And they have them for detention centers and they have them for prisons and jails. And so through that, I started looking into prisons and jails. And that's kind of how I got into criminal justice and wrongful convictions.
I think it's more accurate to say that you don't really work in true crime. You work in crime and justice.
I would like to say that.
That's remained the focus in your shows, which we'll talk more about in a minute. And I think the big focus has been on wrongful convictions. What was the flashpoint for that particular interest? What was your first case in wrongful convictions?
So I believe the first person I started talking to was either David Thorne or Charles Erickson. And Charles Erickson, to me, you know, I had heard about that story for years, Ryan Ferguson and Charles Erickson's wrongful conviction. Ryan Ferguson, of course, was exonerated in 2013, but Charles is still in prison. And I remember when Charles wrote me, I was like, wow, I don't know why I thought that these people wouldn't want to talk for some reason.
If you're familiar with wrongful convictions, you've probably heard of one of the cases Maggie just mentioned. Ryan Ferguson is probably one of the most famous exonerees in the United States. In 2001, he was wrongfully convicted of a murder in his home state of Missouri, a murder that was committed when Ryan was 17. Ryan didn't know the victim, a local journalist named Ken Heitholt, who was murdered late one evening in the parking lot of his place of employment. It was an acquaintance of Ryan's, Charles Erickson, that's the second name Maggie mentioned, who would, unfortunately, tie them both to the case. Charles Erickson often experienced blackouts from alcohol use. On the night of October 31st, 2001, according to his own testimony, Charles used Adderall, cocaine, and drank at a party. According to the Free Charles Erickson website, which summarizes the details that exonerated Ryan Ferguson, Charles caught a ride to a bar with Ryan. This bar was near the Columbia Tribune newspaper office, where Ken Heitholt, the victim, worked. It was around 2 a.m. when Ken Heitholt was found strangled and beaten beside his car. Two members of the janitorial staff saw the apparent murderers, though one of the staff members, Jerry Trump, initially said he could not make out the faces of either person. He changed his story to say he saw Ferguson and Erickson. He was out on probation at the time his story changed. The other staff member, Shauna Orent, saw one of the two figures. She said that neither Ferguson nor Erickson matched the description of the individual, but her testimony was suppressed at trial, resulting in an eventual Brady violation. Charles Erickson eventually confessed to police that he had committed the murder, though he could not supply any details of the crime. He implicated Ferguson as well and accepted a 25-year plea deal to avoid the death penalty. Though evidence at the scene didn't tie either of them to Kevin Heitholt's murder, including hair that didn't match Heitholt, Ferguson, or Erickson, Ferguson was convicted in 2005. Ferguson's pro bono lawyer, Kathleen Zellner, eventually had his sentence overturned in 2013. His conviction was vacated, and the state admitted, quote, overwhelming evidence of innocence, and announced they would not refile charges. But Charles Erickson remains in prison, serving out his 25-year sentence. Ryan Ferguson is now assisting in Charles Erickson's exoneration effort. But as Maggie mentioned, Charles's case has received much less media push, especially as the years since Ryan's exoneration continue to pass.
Patrick Hines, who runs Obsessed Network and True Crime Obsessed, said, you know, I want you on my network. I want you to do a podcast. What do you want to do? Do you want to do Missing People? I was like, I don't want to do Missing People. Not that there isn't a need for it, but I want to do something that I feel like is not covered as much. And so I started looking in the wrongful conviction space, which came through the Suave podcast, Meeting Suave, which I know we're going to talk about, got me really into looking inside at wrongful convictions. And so I started looking, and really the only big podcast that I could find that were covering wrongful convictions were Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff, Undisclosed, Rabia Chaudhry's podcast, and Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. And there's a few others, but those were like the big powerhouses. And I said, you know what? There is space for another one, and we could do it all different. And so I did. I was doing one story a week. And so I reached out to all these people. And when Charles responded, I just couldn't believe he wanted to talk to me, because he was kind of this big name in the space. And I figured he'd be like, whatever, I don't need another thing. And that's when I started realizing, like, no, they need all of the attention they can get to get out of prison.
So you just mentioned reaching out to Charles. How are you finding and selecting cases for Unjust and Unsolved?
So when I first started, so this was in the fall of 2019 when I started reaching out to people. It actually could have been the summer of 2019. I really was just Googling wrongful convictions, and I was looking at some of the big names. You know, there were a lot that I could see already had help or were, you know, in the appeals process, and they were most likely going to get exonerated. So I started reaching out to the people that seemed a little more stuck and could use like a boost of media attention. Someone like Charles, who got a lot of attention when Ryan got out almost a decade ago now and kind of fizzled since then. So I started looking at cases like that, at least for that season. I wasn't able to do a lot of the investigating myself. You know, I was really kind of doing more storytelling and having them tell their own stories. Whereas, you know, Undisclosed was doing a lot of its own investigating. I wasn't. So I really did want to make sure these cases were vetted and that these people were truly believed to be innocent and had, you know, a lot of reasonable doubt. So I made sure to cover cases like that, that had been vetted. PIs, law enforcement have looked at the cases. As the season went on, I got a little more bold. I covered a couple cases that weren't as high profile because I started realizing, you know, those are the cases that need the most attention. But I was still careful to make sure, you know, there was somebody, a PI, you know, advocates who had critically looked at this case and said, you know, this person is certainly innocent beyond a reasonable doubt.
So it sounds like along the way you began to sort of develop your own criteria for finding convictions that you believe to be wrongful. Are there some basic things you look for that are sort of flags that a conviction is wrongful?
Definitely. Jailhouse informants. You know, I've had a couple of cases where the actual perpetrator has come forward before trial and said, hey, I did this. This person didn't do it. And the prosecution completely ignored it. Serious Brady violations, like, you know, withholding witnesses. Cases like that, you know, ones that were in the 70s that now have DNA that can be tested. Like Ronnie Long was recently exonerated. He was in prison for 44 years. I mean, that was a case that it was the first case I covered. That one was just incredible. So cases like that, for sure.
One thing you mentioned that makes the show kind of unique in this space, and I agree, is that most of the shows that cover wrongful convictions are tackling one case per season, and you're dealing with an episodic model, which I think definitely takes a team. So I'd love to hear about who works on the team for Unjust and Unsolved and what skill sets they bring to the cases that you cover.
Yeah, so surprise, there's an incredibly small team of two. It's myself. And Amber Hunt, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, she does the podcast Accused. She's absolutely amazing and a powerhouse. I could not do it without her. But she's my editor. And between us, I mean, that is the team. So that is why we switched formats for season two, and now I'm realizing why there's probably no other podcast that do it like that. I had 21 wrongfully convicted persons I was in touch with, plus their advocates, plus their family members, plus if they had a team of lawyers and investigators to be in touch with on a daily basis was really exhausting. So luckily I had Amber to check my scripts and make sure whatever I was writing was sane and making sense and factual. But other than that, yeah, it was just me, and it was really, really tough.
I don't think I realized it was just you and Amber. I mean, to have Amber, if it was just going to be one other person, I think I would want it to be Amber. But yeah. I don't think I realized it was just the two of you.
Yes. Yeah. So luckily, you know, I come from a public radio background. I've been an audio producer for a very long time. So I have all this skill set that I can do this on my own. It's certainly exhausting to assemble Pro Tools sessions, you know, on a weekly basis, but we made it through. We did it. And we've helped a lot of people in the process.
So I'd love to know a little more about how the subjects on the show participate and how their incarceration impacts their involvement, how prisons have made it possible or impossible for some to participate.
So we were dealing with a very unique situation. When you're trying to talk to somebody who's incarcerated during COVID, it is quite difficult, especially at the beginning. Phone time was either restricted or cut off because of, you know, how germs could be transmitted through a phone. And there was a lot of lockdowns, you know, entire units would go on lockdown. They couldn't leave their cells. So that was very difficult. And initially I was going to be going and visiting everyone in person. The only person I got to do that with was JJ Velasquez, who is in Sing Sing in New York. It's about an hour away. So I did visit him. And the day I was visiting was when we were getting the news that prisons were going to start going on lockdown for COVID. It was the very end of February. So he was the only person I got to visit. I had to cancel visiting Hank Skinner on death row in Texas. They don't have phones on death row. They are not allowed to use the phones in Texas. So the only way I could tell Hank's story was to visit him. So unfortunately, I didn't get to tell his story this season, and he has an incredibly compelling story. So it was really difficult to communicate with them a lot of times. So that was also part of the stress. And I think that's also why, you know, as much as I wanted them to tell their own story, we were up against the clock. We had to get episodes out. And so I specifically think of Ralph Stokes. His audio is not that great because it was him talking to me through the prison phone with his cousin, who was the only person he was able to talk to at the time. So his cousin would call me. So it was like trying to figure out all of these loopholes of how to be able to let them tell their own story, because I didn't want to be the one speaking for them. I wanted them to tell it. So it was difficult. We made it happen. Unfortunately, there were cases I couldn't cover. Darlie Rudier was one of them. Her case is also pretty high profile, but she still desperately needs the media attention. She's been in since the early 90s.
Did any of your subjects face any retribution or punishment for participating?
No, not that I know of. I had one man that I spoke to early on. I reached out to him. His name is Sonny. He's in Georgia. I don't know if you know of his case. His is completely egregious. It was a misidentification. He's an Indian man, and the perpetrator is a black man. And, you know, it's always a wonder how these identifications get mixed up. But he is still in prison, and I really wanted to tell his story. His attorneys did not want that to happen. And I understand why attorneys, you know, often don't want media attention. They think it could hurt. They think it could hurt the case, you know, in court with the judge, or, you know, give fuel to the prosecution. So they really did not want him talking to me. And I absolutely respect that. But he wanted to talk to me. So he was. And his lawyers did admonish him for that. And I think oftentimes they do get scared of their lawyers, you know, leaving them if they don't behave, you know, the way their lawyers tell them to. So I don't know of any specific retribution, at least from prisons, definitely not. But I know some lawyers were definitely mad that they spoke to me, and I had some less than fun conversations with attorneys at times.
I've heard of much worse, so that's actually a relief to hear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of the guys, you know, because COVID, they're desperate and they're not allowed to have cell phones in prison. Of course, that's a huge infraction, but I don't know if you would be surprised or not surprised at how many of them do have cell phones. You know, they would talk to me on phone. So that was definitely a risk that we both took to communicate. They risked, you know, a huge infraction on their record. And I risked being completely banned from visitation phone calls in that state. So, you know, we did take some risks.
Can you talk to us about how your show has affected some or any of the cases that you've worked on so far?
I think, you know, when you're in prison, especially during COVID and really cut off from the world, any communication is just, it will make somebody's week to get a letter. So at the end of each episode, I make a point of saying, you know, write to this person. If you believe in their innocence, even just a letter that says like, hi, I believe in you. And almost every single one of them told me how much it meant to them to have listeners writing to them. So just emotionally, there was impact. But I mean, a lot of the cases also had tangible impact, like David Thorne's case. A listener reached out. The only reason we're able to hire Proclaim Justice to do this is because a listener reached out and said, I, you know, 100% believe in his innocence. I cannot believe he's been in prison 22 years and for the past 10 years hasn't had any professionals working on his case. I want to donate $25,000 to help him. So we connected David with Proclaim Justice, and that was because of a listener. JJ Velasquez, I was fortunately able to air his episode on NPR's Latino USA, which airs on local stations across the country. And folks who were listening to WNYC in New York, a congressman heard and reached out to JJ and wants to join his team. I'm trying to think of some of the others. Temujin Kensu, in Michigan. He's been in prison for 34 years. It is one of the more egregious ones that I've seen. A teacher heard his story. She was a listener of the podcast, and I believe she teaches a forensics class and has her students listen to Unjust and Unsolved to, you know, hear how things were messed up and then talk to them about, you know, how they would do it. She had, when I told listeners to email, write the governor on Temujin's behalf, she got all of her students to write all of the politicians. And that was 34 emails and letters. And so they started this whole campaign and they got on local news. So that was very, very cool to get that attention for Temujin. And Ralph Stokes is on death row. And his story, it was the first time he had ever told his story publicly. And now we have actively gotten his attorneys to finally work on his case. They've been on his case for over 10 years and have not done anything. And after they heard the episode and heard that people were finally paying attention, they finally decided to file something in court.
That's a major misconception, I think, that maybe a lot of us have, is that just because someone has attorneys, that the attorneys are working on their case?
Yeah. Yeah. He has, because he's on death row in Pennsylvania, he has federal defenders, which is, you know, very similar to a public defender hired, but these are federal because it's a death row case. They haven't done anything for over a decade. Ralph was very frustrated. They specifically told him not to talk to me, and he did. He was like, I am fed up with them. It's been over 10 years. I am languishing on death row. He has been on death row for 40 years. He's in his 60s now. And they called myself and Lisa Spees, his advocate, his justice warriors. And we're like, we heard you and your justice warriors on that podcast. And, you know, it was pretty obvious to him that the only reason they were, you know, finally coming to visit him and finally talking to him was because we called them out in the podcast.
Most of the cases Maggie mentioned are covered on her podcast, Unjust and Unsolved. JJ Velasquez's coverage was actually on NPR's Latino USA, where they discussed his conviction for the 1998 shooting of a police officer in Harlem. JJ Velasquez had an alibi, quote, yet was placed in a lineup and identified as the shooter, despite alibi disparity between the appearance and race of the witness descriptions and JJ. Ralph Stokes was 19 when he was arrested in 1982 for a triple homicide committed during a robbery. He'd been an employee at the restaurant where the robbery took place. Supporters point to the record of prosecutorial misconduct on the part of the DA and the questionable motives of the witnesses in the case, as well as the lack of physical evidence at the scene. The Georgia case is that of Sonny Baradia, whose case has been taken up by the Georgia Innocence Project. In 2001, Sonny reported his car stolen by an acquaintance. Across the state, a robbery and sexual assault were committed by a man wearing batting gloves. Gloves that would later be found in Sonny's car. The Innocence Project cites misidentification, misconduct, and exculpatory DNA evidence in Sonny's case. Specifically, that the DNA in the gloves matched Sonny's acquaintance and not Sonny. Sonny is still incarcerated. In Michigan, Temujin Kinsu was convicted of killing Scott Macklem, the fiancé of his former girlfriend. It was 1986, and per the Detroit News, quote, nine alibi witnesses put Kinsu 450 miles away from the crime, with no physical evidence tying him to the scene. You've probably heard of Darlie Rudier's case. It's one of the most famous in the United States. She was charged in the killing of her 5 and 6-year-old sons and convicted and sentenced to death in one of the murders. Darlie has always maintained that her children were killed by an intruder. Hank Skinner, who sits on Texas's death row, has raised questions about DNA results in his case. He was tried for the murders of his girlfriend, Twyla Busby, and her adult sons, Elwin Kaler and Randy Busby. What have you learned doing this work recently about the criminal justice system and the penal system? Or maybe what views do you have that have changed or become more nuanced since you began your podcasts?
It's such a complicated question. I would say, you know, everything has probably become more nuanced. Like, it's not black and white anymore. You know, I guess before I started this, I didn't pay too much attention to the death penalty, particularly. I know that I personally was against it. I live in a state where we don't have the death penalty. But then, you know, you hear these people with the arguments like, well, it saves the state money. Like, they're just, you know, paying for them to eat and they're a convicted killer. And I guess really when I started this work, I started realizing how many people are actually on death row, like Hank Skinner and Ralph Stokes and Jeff Havard actually had his sentence commuted. He's off death row, but he was. These are all innocent people that would be sentenced to death. And that was never really part of my thought process on the death penalty. I just didn't believe it was right to kill somebody, even if they had, allegedly. But the nuance of realizing, you know, actually there's innocent people there, and it's so egregious how many innocent people we do kill. It's horrible. You know, and I guess one of the other surprising things is that there is really no uniform system of compensating people who have been wrongfully convicted. There's only 30-something states that even have any form of like compensation on the books that say if you've been wrongfully convicted, you get X amount of money for X amount of years. That there's like, I think it was like 15 states that don't have anything like that. And you don't really get compensated and you just get thrown out of prison after spending decades and have to just start your life over on your own. The government doesn't compensate you for their mistake. So that was something that was really, truly shocking. And even if there is compensation, they still have to usually file a civil lawsuit, which also takes years. So, I mean, it's really, truly disgusting how we strip people of their lives and rights, and then we just kill them and or don't compensate them when they are released. Was shocking.
I'm just thinking about it. Yeah, I know. I could go on and on about juvenile sentences too.
Well, yeah. I mean, and juvenile sentences. I mean, that's part of it too, because that's really how I got on this with the Suave podcast. And that was something that. I was going to say this in part of the nuance is Suave, this was somebody who always admit to the crime that, you know, he said like, yes, I was 17 and I, you know, was involved in the killing of a 13-year-old boy. They were in street gangs and selling drugs in the 80s in Philadelphia. And Suave never said, you know, I didn't do that. He owned up to it. He was sentenced to life without parole. And in prison, changed and became this incredible human with, you know, he started like philanthropic groups inside of prison. And these guys would do fundraisers and give the money to charities. And he started this program for children whose fathers are incarcerated. Like Suave just became this amazing person. And fortunately, laws were changed where you cannot mandatorily sentence a child to spend the rest of their life in prison without parole. So Suave was released and is doing incredible work on the outside. He's now involved in Ralph Stokes' case in Pennsylvania, the one who I mentioned on death row. He's now working to help wrongfully convicted people and just even people in prison for unjust sentences. That made me realize that people are capable of change and reform, and the way that we do things in this country, lock up and throw the key and don't reform people, is such an issue because people like Suave do get out and laws do change. And when these people do get out, you know, they have nothing. They haven't been educated. But I don't think people realize when you have a life without parole sentence, you are generally not allowed to take any sort of educational classes. You know, and then if you get exonerated or laws change and you get out, you're just, you know, virtually a child. A lot of them are locked up as kids and they get out. And how are they supposed to have jobs? How are they supposed to be contributing members of society when we treat them like garbage when we put them in prison? So, I mean, I could go on forever. It's just so nuanced and there's so much to it.
Maggie's first podcast on incarceration looked not at wrongful convictions, but at the juvenile justice system, life sentences, and the experience of one man, David Luis Suave Gonzalez, who was convicted of murder at 17. Talk to us about the show that you hosted and co-produced, Suave. How did this project come about?
So I had been working on Suave since 2018. It was when I was doing the border reporting and detention center reporting with Maria Hinojosa, the founder of Futuro Media, Latino USA. I was the producer at large for Latino USA. So we were traveling the country doing all these stories together, and we really grew this very strong bond. I mean, Maria is an amazing journalist, an amazing woman, an amazing human. And so we bonded really a lot. And so she had this relationship with this man in prison, David Luis Suave Gonzalez. And they had known each other since 1994, only a few years after he was locked up. So he was in his 20s. He was a kid in prison. And Maria met him when she went to do a talk at Greaterford Prison in Pennsylvania. And, you know, you could hear in the podcast what, you know, how she talks about why they kept in touch, but they kept in touch. So now, you know, 3 decades later, this man in his 50s who was sentenced to die in prison gets out. Laws changed. And Maria then knew, you know, this is the story that in my gut for 3 decades, I knew was going to happen. She was waiting for it. So we had this. And because me and her were so close and she trusted me as a producer, she looked at me and said, I need you to make this into a podcast. And I'm just like, what? What am I? I didn't know anything, you know, at the time. First of all, when this happened, this was like 4 years ago. So yeah, I was in my late 20s. Like, I wasn't really in this world yet. I didn't realize how significant it was that Suave got out, what it meant for to have the Supreme Court change a law like that for over 2,000 people across the country. So she's like, here's thousands of hours of phone tape since 1994. Go through it and see, you know, what we could do with this story. And I was like, Jesus, oh my God. So I did. I started going through all of this phone tape of just their phone calls, their recorded phone calls for decades. And I mean, that's how the project was really born. I brought on Julieta Martinelli. I said, you know, I obviously can't do this myself. I need a team. I brought on Julieta, who was skilled in criminal justice, particularly wrongful convictions and juvenile justice. So she was amazing to work with. And, you know, together we created this podcast that is a beautiful story about Suave's life, about a relationship between a journalist and a source, about juveniles in prison. I mean, there's so many layers to it.
Did you consider having Maria host or Suave himself?
So there was many talks about this. I don't like telling people's stories. I always want them to tell their own stories. So it was always going to be Suave in conversation and Suave talking about his experiences. I personally don't feel comfortable speaking for a brown man who's been incarcerated when I'm a white woman who's never been incarcerated. I needed him to tell his own story. It wasn't mine to tell. So he was never going to be the narrator, but he was definitely going to be in conversation. And in terms of Maria, you know, when we went through this tape, Julieta and I really at one point, we both took off our headphones and were just like, no way, no way. She cannot tell this story because whether she wants to believe it or not, she is so invested. And we can see that there's more than just a professional relationship here. She deeply cares about this man. And they have some sort of friendship, some sort of relationship that she would not be trusted as a narrator. It wasn't whether we trusted her. We felt that the audience wouldn't trust her because she was so close. And so I sat down with her one time. We were in Austin. We were reporting on the Hutto Detention Center, an all-women's detention center down there, which is notorious for incredible human rights abuses. And I sat her down. We were drinking mezcal, trying to just let the day go. And I said, look, I'm going to tell you something. We don't think you can host this. And you're going to be a character in your pet project. And she trusts me. She said, you know, I'm going to think about it, but I trust that you guys know what decisions to make. And it was definitely the right decision. Because some people didn't even trust me based on the comments. They thought I was too close. So I'm very glad that we did it the way we did.
I think it takes the three of you to tell the story about youth incarceration. Because the host is not the protagonist often. The host sets the scene that allows the protagonist to tell the story. And you just simply are able to go up the ladder and give us the facts and then let them talk and speak.
Totally. And I think it worked. I think it absolutely worked. And I think some of the best moments were actually when I had Maria and Suave sit down in the studio with me and asked them, you know, very candid questions about their relationship, which did catch them off guard. And they answered incredibly honestly. And I think if Maria was hosting, we might not have had those moments.
Yeah, because it's a unique relationship.
It's incredibly unique. I mean, and that was part of it too, part of the thought process of, you know, at the time that the Supreme Court made the decision to resentence all juvenile lifers who were mandatorily sentenced, a lot of people were reporting on this. I know Frontline did some amazing reporting on it. And so we were trying to think, how do we do this different? And nobody else had a journalist and a child who was sentenced to die in prison have a 30-year relationship. And so we just knew that it had to be that way.
How has Suave's story developed further since the launch of the podcast?
So Suave, I mean, like I said, he is brilliant. He is educated. He is street smart. He's been inside the system. So once the country knew about him, he was in very high demand for people to want to talk to him. And you know, he got to be on MSNBC, which was like a dream of his because he had always watched Maria on MSNBC. And then he finally got to be on with her. So, you know, he got to do a lot of amazing things. He now has his own podcast, which was a dream of his. He would listen to Maria on Latino USA every week in prison. It's called Death by Incarceration. And it's Suave doing what he wants to do, talking about people who, you know, are not necessarily sentenced to the death penalty, but a life without parole sentence is death by incarceration. So he talks to people and politicians, lawmakers, about the criminal justice system. And it's amazing.
I watched him do a live Get Vocal with Tim and Lance from Crawl Space recently, mm-hmm. and I was really blown away with him talking about that and also showing some of his artwork.
Oh, yeah. He's an amazing artist. So that was something we didn't even get to put in the podcast because there was so much and the higher-ups were, like, you know, very set on 7 episodes. But Suave, while in prison, he was part of this prison mural project. And the prisoners, a select number of them, were able to paint murals across the city of Philadelphia. They painted them in prison, but it was on like material that could be plastered up. So he has about 30 murals across the city of Philadelphia that he participated in while in prison. And they are gorgeous. I mean, they are all about prison reform and human rights and civil rights. And he took us around and showed us some of them. And there's a photo of his mother in one of them that he painted, who, you know, died while he was in prison. And we talk a lot about her in the podcast. But that's just one of the amazing things Suave has done is these murals on the streets of Philadelphia while inside prison.
And that's a way he's also earning a living now, right?
His art, yeah. I mean, like I said, he was in high demand when he got out. He's worked for the police. He's worked in shelters. He's does a lot of outreach. He was offered a campaign staff position with some Philadelphia politicians. So yeah, he has work, but he does his art, which he loves. That's what's really interesting and unique. And it goes back to the whole education. When you have a life without parole sentence, Suave was able to take classes. Suave has a college degree. And, you know, like I said, so he got out and there were opportunities for him. But most people with life without parole sentences cannot do that. So if they get out, their opportunities are incredibly limited. You know, I'm not going to give away for listeners what happens to Suave, but even though he is such a success story and he had everything set up for him for success when he got out, you know, connections with prominent journalists and politicians and people, the system even gets him at one point. And it's devastating. And it's like, if even Suave gets screwed, think of the person who didn't have these opportunities.
Maggie's point here covers a lot of ground. The lack of education and training programs offered to all people in the prison system, but especially to those with life sentences. Because of two different Supreme Court decisions in the last 9 years, there have been over 2,000 juvenile life sentences overturned. Those who entered the system as juveniles with life sentences could have spent decades with no access to the education or training programs that Suave had. Many of the people reentering society are now in their 50s and their 60s. According to a 2018 article from the Philadelphia Inquirer, there are groups working to help with those transitions, mostly nonprofits, faith-based groups, and a few state programs. A standout is the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project, but there isn't a nationwide solution or infrastructure. And there hasn't been a nationwide end to juvenile life sentences or sentencing. Those decisions are still being made on the state level. Right now, you're focusing on a single case for an entire season, Murder and Alliance, and that's the conviction of David Thorne. What made you choose this conviction for a series?
As I mentioned, he was one of the first people I spoke to. He was so eager to have his story told. And something about David as a person really stuck out to me. I don't blame anybody that I speak to who's been wrongfully incarcerated for decades to be a little bitter and gruff. But David was like this sweet, caring, kind, understanding, just lovely human. He built cars and motorcycles, and I ride a motorcycle, so we would talk about that. Just drawn to him as a person. But the case, I mean, when I got done with this 40-minute episode, I was just consumed. I couldn't think about anything else. And I didn't plan to do season two as a full series on one case. So I started telling everybody about him. You know, when TV, like when producers would reach out to me and say, hey, we want to turn Unjustly Unsolved into a TV show. I'd always talk about David's case because there was a major opportunity to exonerate him because there was so much that hadn't been done and needed to be done. It's just that kind of case that you can't stop thinking about. I just had to do something. I had to help him.
And I know you're still working on the case right now and in real time. So I won't ask you to, you know, share what you're finding, but you are finding quite a lot, right?
That's what's so incredible is that if the detectives even did the slightest bit of investigation, they would have found what we found. I mean, it was not hard to find anything. We have found some very good persons of interest. And, you know, Sue Thorne, who is now his wife, was not back then. She was a postal worker in this small town in Ohio. She uncovered the most evidence. Like, we wouldn't really be here if it weren't for Sue doing boots on the groundwork, literally, after his conviction. She just knew him from the post office and was like, this guy didn't do this. 2000. You know, before people were talking about wrongful convictions, Sue was like, you know what, this guy didn't do this, and just started knocking on doors and finding out the truth. And like I said, it wasn't hard. This person who has no investigative skills was able to find out information that the police, I believe, intentionally ignored.
And no one had talked to her about what she'd found?
Oh, the police didn't care. She had been screaming at the top of her lungs forever. I mean, the reason he even had any appeals was because of her, and she was the one who was able to, you know, get him attorneys. You know, unfortunately, he's used up all of his appeals. But she found a witness who the police knew of and suppressed. I mean, that was a Brady violation that went to appeal. It was a witness who saw somebody leaving the house the morning of her murder. This man was in the house with a dead body. And this witness saw him leaving and picked him out in a lineup. And for whatever reason, that lineup disappeared. There's no record of it. There's no record of any interviews with him. And she found him.
So in Murder and Alliance, the chance to involve Jason Baldwin, who I'm sure most listeners are familiar with from the West Memphis 3, and his organization is pretty incredible. Can you talk a little bit about Jason's current work and what he focuses on, and if you envision working with him on wrongful convictions in the future?
Yeah, so I absolutely envision working with Jason in the future. We have become friends now. I was just with him in Austin for no other reason than to just hang out. You know, we started working together on other cases besides David. I learned of his organization when I was looking at cases to cover for Unjust. You know, I'd always known about the West Memphis 3. I'd always followed that case. Paradise Lost are some of my favorite documentaries. So when I found out he had this organization that was helping to free the wrongfully convicted, I was like, this is incredible. It's called Proclaim Justice. And I reached out to them to cover some of their cases on the podcast. And they were more than happy to bring attention to them. So I flew down there and met him. And he helped me, him and John Harden, the co-founder, Jason's longtime friend, former advocate when he was in prison, and now the PI of Proclaim Justice. We covered Nikki Zinger's case in Arkansas. We covered DeMarco Wilson's case in Arkansas, which they call the West Memphis 3 2.0 because it's a lot of the same players that wrongfully convicted Jason. And we covered the Diamantina Salinas Kalahako case. A convicted serial killer admitted to that murder. So I got to know him through that. And then I mentioned David's case. Like I said, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And it's all just, you know, when I think that I'm working with Jason Baldwin on wrongful convictions, that was never something 16-year-old Maggie obsessed with Paradise Lost would have ever thought. But I am very lucky. He's an amazing person. And I do look forward to working with him on more things.
If you could pick one thing, what would be the biggest single reform that we could make that could have a major positive impact on the number of wrongful convictions that happen in this country?
So I have two, and I'm sure there's a million others. So one is ending qualified immunity, which basically shields officers from being held personally accountable in civil rights lawsuits, violations, you know, coercing children to give false confessions. Police are protected from that. So I think if they knew they were going to be held accountable, they would do that less. And the other one is conviction review units. This is a new thing, which I don't know if people know that. There are actually only 6 states that have the CIU that go through the state's attorney general's office. 6 states. Minnesota is the newest. So we need to really work on getting conviction review units in place, especially through the attorney general's office, to look at these cases. And even the states that do have it now, they are inundated. So we need them. We need to expand them. It's incredible that this didn't exist before.
I know what you're currently working on, which is Murder and Alliance, but what's next for you?
Just continuing to do this work. I have fallen in love with it. I've fallen in love with the people in this community, not only those who are wrongfully convicted, but their advocates, their families. I don't see myself stepping away from this work.
How can our listeners support your work and the cases of the wrongfully convicted that you're working with?
So I do have a Patreon where the money goes to helping the folks when they get out or even while they're in, whatever they need. Recently, we were able to buy Rosa Jimenez, who just got out, a new washer and dryer for her house. You know, I give a lot of that money. Kenneth Nixon recently got out. I gave a lot of money to him to help get on his feet. So, you know, the Patreon really helps with that when people come to me and say, like, you know, hey, I just got out, or here's my, you know, petition or whatever. That helps a lot. But also, if you just go to the Unjust and Unsolved website, there are ways to write all of these people. Please write them if you believe in them, which I hope you do. And just let them know you care. There are people that care and are listening, and they are not silenced, and their voices are heard. And in terms of David's case, you can donate to Proclaim Justice. You could donate directly to David. And right now I'm doing an email blast to all Ohio politicians, letting them know that this is an utter shame for the state of Ohio, that this man has been in prison for 22 years and the circumstances are absolutely disgusting. So you can find how to email the politicians. The email's already set up. It is pre-populated. You literally just click the link, put your name in, and hit send. You can find that on my website, and you can find it on the Murder in Alliance website.
Thanks so much to Maggie Freeling for joining us. You can find links to her shows and her website, where you can learn more about her work, in our show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Milbrook Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. Each and every one of our patrons help us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Family interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please, join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of PIs.